KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. Israel's Security Cabinet has approved a Gaza ceasefire deal. Full cabinet is due to vote on the agreement later today. We speak with former Israeli ambassador to the U.S., Michael Oren, on Morning Edition from the Guardians. Weight loss drugs Ozempic and Wegovy are among 15 drugs up for price negotiations. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Michelle Martin. The Supreme Court has upheld the ban on TikTok, which is set to begin this weekend. What's next for the popular video sharing app and its users? Plus, an exit interview with the Biden administration's ambassador to China and grading President Biden's record on education. It is Friday, January 17th. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is still waiting for his Senate confirmation hearing to lead the Department of Health and Human Services, but today he celebrates his 71st birthday. And the news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that a federal law banning video sharing app TikTok can take effect. The law demands that TikTok's parent company sell it off because the Chinese owners could misuse Americans' personal data. The Supreme Court ruled unanimously the law is sufficiently based on national security reasons and does not infringe free speech rights. President-elect Trump says the decision whether to enforce the law is up to him. The Biden White House has released a statement saying Americans should be allowed to continue using TikTok, but under American or other ownership that addresses national security concerns. That statement from the Biden White House comes after Biden signed the TikTok ban into law last year. President-elect Trump's nominee to head the Department of Homeland Security is appearing at her Senate confirmation hearing, South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem.
The challenges in front of us are extremely significant, and we must secure our borders against illegal trafficking and immigration. We must safeguard our critical infrastructure to make sure that we're protected against cyber attacks, respond to natural disasters, and also terrorism.
Noem supports Trump's immigration policies. President Biden says he considers the Equal Rights Amendment to be part of the Constitution. NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben reports Biden's declaration has no force of law.
In a statement, Biden declared the 28th Amendment is the law of the land, guaranteeing all Americans equal rights and protections under the law, regardless of their sex. Congress originally passed the ERA in 1972, but the required 38 states had not ratified it by a 1982 deadline. States continued ratifying it, though, and in 2020, Virginia became the 38th. Senior administration officials told reporters that Biden wants the archivist to publish the amendment, a crucial final hurdle for it. However, they said he is not directing her to do so. ERA backers plan to rally today in front of the National Archives. Danielle Kurtzleben, NPR News.
The Biden administration has announced more medications that will be targeted for lower prices under Medicare. NPR's Sydney Lupkin reports negotiating drug prices in Medicare is a new power created by Biden's Inflation Reduction Act.
The federal government and the pharmaceuticals industry are about to go head-to-head once again. In its last full weekday in office, the Biden administration has named the next 15 drugs up for price negotiation in Medicare. Ozempic is on the list. The type 2 diabetes blockbuster drug is joined by its obesity drug cousin, Wegovy, as well as drugs for various cancers, asthma, psoriasis, and bipolar disorder. The government can't pick just any drugs in Medicare. There are certain rules laid out in the Inflation Reduction Act that say which drugs are eligible. The negotiations will take place in the coming months. Sydney Lufkin, NPR News.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up about 400 points at 43,552. This is NPR. The Israeli Security Cabinet has approved the proposed ceasefire deal with Hamas to halt fighting in Gaza. The office of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says the full Israeli cabinet will meet later today to consider it as well. The deal was initially announced Wednesday by mediators, but Netanyahu's office said there were unresolved issues and blamed Hamas. Hamas rejected that. Fire crews in the Los Angeles area are making progress against two major blazes. More than 12,000 structures have been damaged or lost. At least 25 people have been killed. NPR's Laurel Walmsley reports on the growing number of private firefighters in the L.A. region who are being hired by insurance companies and wealthy people.
There have been reports in recent days of a few wealthy Angelenos hiring private firefighters to protect their homes and businesses. but more common are crews working on behalf of insurance companies. David Torgerson is executive chairman at Wildfire Defense Companies, which works for nearly three dozen insurers.
We clean, we sweep, we clear gutters, we take away the places where the embers can ignite on the property, or take away the access that the embers have to get in the buildings.
Saving more structures means insurance companies can reduce losses, and these services now come standard on some homeowner policies in fire-prone states. But not everyone has this kind of coverage, or any coverage, as rates have skyrocketed in recent years. Laurel Wamsley, NPR News.
The private company SpaceX says it is investigating why its huge rocket, Starship, failed after it launched yesterday. Debris from the uncrewed rocket rained down over the Atlantic Ocean after the explosion. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Imaginable Futures, celebrating the hard work, commitment, and achievements of the 1 in 5 college students who are parents. More at imaginablefutures.com. This is NPR.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Faldin. Good morning. The Supreme Court has upheld a ban on the popular short video app TikTok that takes effect in just 2 days on Sunday. That's unless the app sells its U.S. operations away from a Chinese company. The court unanimously affirmed a lower court ruling holding that the national security concerns about the app are the number one concern. It's unclear what could come next under President-elect Donald Trump, who once agreed with the ban but now has vowed to save it. And NPR's Bobby Allen joins me now to discuss. Hey, Bobby.
Hey, Leila.
Okay, so what did the court just decide exactly?
The court decided that the national security concerns that Congress established about TikTok are indeed the paramount concern here. And I want to quote sort of the crux of the matter here, which was an opinion. It was unsigned by the court. And they say, quote, "There is no doubt that for the more than 170 million Americans, TikTok offers a distinct and expansive outlet for expression, means of engagement, and source of community. But Congress has determined that divestiture is necessary to address its well-supported national security concerns." So basically what this decision is saying is Congress decided that TikTok is a threat. They said, the users said that they have First Amendment concerns, but the Supreme Court here is deferring to the judgment of Congress.
Hmm. Now, the law, as we mentioned, it would go into effect on Sunday. So what exactly would happen?
There's so much uncertainty right now. As you said, in 2 days, this law takes effect, which means Apple and Google will have to yank TikTok out of app stores, and all of TikTok's web support will have to sever ties with the app. Or face really, really stiff penalties. We're talking $5,000 per user, and this law applies, the statute of limitations on it, is for 5 years. So the companies that are backing up TikTok, that keep TikTok online, mm-hmm. are going to have to act. That said, you know, Biden signed this law, but, you know, he came out with a statement today saying that TikTok should remain available to Americans. So many are trying to make sense of that. On top of that, President-elect Donald Trump says he wants to save the app. So there's just a lot going on here politically.
Okay, so kind of a dumb question maybe, but come Sunday, if an American wants to open their TikTok app, can they?
We don't know. TikTok has said that it is possible they will go dark on the 19th. TikTok's lawyers said that to the court last Friday, and I was there and heard it, and it was a pretty stunning revelation. The more reporting I did on this, Layla, the more I understood it, and it, you know, it's possible that when 170 million Americans open up their app on Sunday, they get a dialogue box that pops up and says, this service is no longer available in your region. But it might not. We just don't know exactly how the company is going to respond, but I do know that that is among the many options.
Okay, now, President-elect Trump, has he said anything about the decision?
I haven't seen any statement yet from President-elect Trump, but the past several months, he has said he will figure out a way to keep TikTok alive. Remember, he started the TikTok ban movement during his first term. Then he flip-flopped and said, you know, TikTok was great in terms of getting the youth vote out. And now he is determined to figure out a way to keep it around in America that could look like, you know, pushing it off for 90 days, which the law allows, or trying to broker some kind of fire sale to bring in some American companies, American investors, to try to get China to offload the app and have it under new ownership. But that that remains to be seen. And the big question now, Layla, is what happens Sunday? Will it be there? Will it not? We just don't know. But there is just a lot of fear among TikTokers and a lot of dread on the app.
That's NPR's Bobby Allen. Thank you, Bobby.
Thanks, Layla.
Israel's Security Cabinet approved a ceasefire deal this morning that would halt the fighting in Gaza and allow for the release of a group of Palestinian prisoners in exchange for the release of some of the hostages taken by Hamas during their October 7th massacre in southern Israel. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's full cabinet is due to meet later today for a final vote. We've been reporting a variety of reactions to these ground-shifting events, and now we want to hear from Michael Oren. He is a former Israeli ambassador to the United States, a former member of the Knesset, and he's been following these events closely. He's with us now. Good morning, Ambassador.
Good morning. Good morning to you both.
This ceasefire deal is very similar to the one President Biden proposed months ago, which Israel initially rejected. What's changed to make this deal acceptable now? What's your take on that?
I think two things have happened. One, that Hamas has agreed to some essential issues in that negotiation, including letting Israel know which hostages are about to be released. Before, they would not release any of the names. There are differences over the number and identity of the Palestinian prisoners who are going to be released from Israeli jails, and the question of from what parts of Gaza the Israeli Defense Forces would withdraw in the first of the first three phases. I think a big change, and you have to say this, is because there's a new president coming in, and he has a tremendous amount of influence over both Hamas and over Israel. Hamas because he threatened, quote-unquote, to let all hell break loose if they didn't release the hostages, and also because his relationship with Benjamin Netanyahu is such that he can give Netanyahu a much shorter, what we say, lease, leash, and say, listen, I want this by the time I'm inaugurated, and it happens.
Based on your knowledge of the situation and the players, and I apologize if I'm asking you to speculate, do you think this deal will hold?
I think the first phase will hold. Hamas violated a ceasefire on October 7, 2023. It violated the last ceasefire in November 2023. So Hamas has not been known to keep ceasefires. And there'd be a large part of the Israeli public, not a majority part, but a large part, which wouldn't regret if Hamas were to break the ceasefire and Israel renew the efforts to destroy Hamas, because that is what the Israeli government has promised, is promised total victory. It's very difficult to get the total victory as long as Hamas has hostages, because Israel's previous assumption that by increasing military pressure on Hamas, Hamas would release the hostages, that was disproven, was because when Israel increased military pressure, Hamas didn't release hostages, it shot the hostages. So as long as Hamas has hostages and will have almost 60 hostages will remain in captivity, many of them may be alive, we don't know, it'll be very difficult to Israel achieve the total victory, even if the ceasefire breaks down.
So to that end, how then is peace achieved? I do want to mention that you wrote a piece this week saying that this hostage deal is, it's titled, "The Hostage Deal is the Price of Israel's Failures." And in this piece, you say that Israel's twin goals in Gaza were fundamentally irreconcilable, to both destroy Hamas and free the hostages. Given that you say that, what would it take to achieve a lasting peace and to free all of the hostages?
And I think that's the hardest part, because a lasting peace you can't have with Hamas. Hamas is dedicated to Israel's destruction. Hamas is a terrorist organization. Hamas is firing at Israel even as we speak. There have been rockets fired along the border, even at Jerusalem, and soldiers have been killed. So Hamas is still there. And if you have a Israeli withdrawal, complete withdrawal, Hamas will emerge from the tunnels and it will reconquer the Gaza Strip. And then it will mount the next October 7th, because that's precisely what its leader said they're going to do. They said they would do it 10,000 times until Israel's destroyed. And as long as Hamas is there, as long as it has hostages, that was my point, it is very difficult for Israel to achieve that twin goal of destroying Hamas and releasing the hostages, because the more military pressure you put on Hamas, they shoot the hostages. They don't let them go. And for Israeli society, it's a particular quality of Israeli society that the hostages mean everything to us. And Israeli mothers will say, we won't send our kids to the army unless the hostages are released. It's a sort of a covenant in Israeli society. So it's a quandary. It's a terrible, terrible quandary, and one that's never been faced by any country, certainly not by Israel. And there's no quick fix. What the government is hoping, what Netanyahu is hoping, is that the second and third phases will be violated by Hamas and that the war will resume. And the hope is that some hostages will be able to be saved in one way or another. And there's no perfect way forward. You speak of peace. I think Israelis are not thinking about peace right now. They're thinking about how to maybe end the war and get the hostages back in the best way possible.
I take your point on that. I just as a sort of a point of in fairness, there is, as we know, an existing ceasefire arrangement in Lebanon, and there are reports that both sides have already violated that deal, even though that it seems to be holding in large part, but there are reports that both sides have violated that ceasefire deal. So to that end, if I may ask you, I would love for you to say more about the covenant that you say with the hostages in Israeli society, why getting all of them back, including those who have been killed, is such an important part of the covenant, as you said, of Israeli society. And before I let you go, I do want to ask if you would save some time to say, if you were advising the Netanyahu government on next steps at this point, I would love to know what you would advise them.
Okay, thank you. It's just a peculiar nature of Israel and of the Jewish people. It's deeply embedded in Jewish law. It is a commandment in the Torah to do everything possible to redeem captives and hostages. And it's hardwired into our society. Give an example. On December 8th, 1941, President Roosevelt didn't say, well, the Japanese have taken thousands of prisoners. We can't go to war against the Japanese. He said we have to have unconditional surrender. So it's not a big part of American consciousness, but it's huge for Israel.
I see.
And the state of Israel comes into being saying, we're going to defend the land and the people of Israel. But the other part of the covenant says that if anybody's taken captive in the course of defending the country has to do everything possible to get them back.
I appreciate
that
explanation.
Now, mothers will say they won't. They won't send their kids to the army unless the hostages are are redeemed. What I would say to the Prime Minister is, yes, go for this deal the best you can. Get as many hostages back. Get an understanding with this new president, not just about Gaza, but about Lebanon, and above all about Iran. And get the big picture, because Gaza, as painful, as excruciating as it is part of a regional strategic issue and the big, big threat, both to the United States, to Israel, and all the, you know, America's allies in the Middle East is the regime in Iran.
That is Michael Oren. He is a former Israeli ambassador to the United States, a former member of the Knesset, and an author and historian. Ambassador Oren, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
Colson Whitehead's Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, The Nickel Boys, has been adapted for the big screen. On the next Fresh Air, we'll listen back to our 2019 interview with him when his novel was just published. It's set in the early 60s, based on the true story of the Dozier Reform School in Florida, where many boys were beaten and sexually abused. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Sony Pictures Classics with The Room Next Door, starring Julianne Moore and Tilda Swinton. After years apart, two friends meet again in an extreme situation. Directed by Pedro Almodovar, now playing only in theaters. From Eric and Wendy Schmidt, through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. From Cunard, with round trips from Miami to the Caribbean on Cunard's Queen Elizabeth. Guests can dine on flavors of the Caribbean and explore local life on shore in Antigua, Barbados, St. Lucia, and beyond. Learn more at cunard.com. And from the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing transformative youth and criminal justice reforms.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Nicholas Burns is home from China. The U.S. diplomat served as President Biden's ambassador there. He returned to resign as the administration ends. And in a State Department office, he sat to take our questions.
Is China still a country on the rise?
I think China is a country that wants to be on the rise. It has a big view of itself, its leadership, and its role in the world.
Ambassador Burns said it's also a country that faces a slowing economy and a declining population.
You say China wants to be a country on the rise. Is there an open question in your mind as to whether the arrow on the chart is pointing up a little or pointing down at this point?
I answered it that way, Steve, because I'm just finishing up my ambassadorship. And when I was being confirmed by the U.S. Senate more than 3 years ago, I remember several senators asking me about Xi Jinping's maxim, the East is rising and the West is falling. Well, how does that look 3.5 years later?
Burns says the U.S. economy is stronger and so are its relations with allies. President Trump imposed tariffs on China in his first term. President Biden added more and blocked Chinese access to the highest technology. But China has lately hacked U.S. telephone networks and threatens Taiwan, which the U.S. has effectively committed to defend. So I asked if China could use its trade with the U.S. to disrupt the U.S. economy.
We should not be unduly dependent on an authoritarian country like China. So we're trying to, and working, I think, successfully in some respects, to alter those supply chains, to bring them back to the United States.
But as of now, is the answer yes, they could put pressure on the United States?
Well, they're trying. So for instance, Steve, over the last 30 to 40 days, the Chinese have taken measures to restrict the sale of germanium and gallium and antimony, but there are other sources of supply in Canada, in Germany, and in the United States. We've got to re-engineer these supply chains because we did learn that fundamental lesson in the pandemic.
Marco Rubio, Senator Marco Rubio, who is President Trump's nominee for Secretary of State, did his confirmation hearing this week and, among other things, described the U.S.-China relationship as unbalanced. By which I believe he means we're more dependent on them or more vulnerable to them than the other way around. Do you agree with that?
I think, you know, there's a degree of mutual dependence if you look at our economic relationship. But I think that Senator Rubio is correct to say we've got to continue this effort that President Biden started to make sure that we're not unduly dependent in areas that are critical.
Some of the people who are connected with the new administration have an opinion about Russia and China. And they would like to drive Russia and China apart, which might mean being friendlier with Russia, hard to say. But what do you think about when you hear about that goal, to pry Russia and China apart for the benefit of the U.S.?
I think we have to stand up for American interests. And in the case of China, it's to compete with them and yet try to engage them when it's in our interest to do so. In the case of Russia, it's to stand up to them and to try to help Ukraine avoid a takeover by the Russian Federation. I mean, if there's a valiant cause in the world today, it's the cause of Ukraine. President Biden has stood up for Ukraine, and he's rallied the rest of the world, the democratic world, to support it. We shouldn't walk away from that.
There's another thing that I hear from people who are connected with the new administration, and that is the idea that the United States could be doing a lot more to pressure China to back away from Russia.
Well, we are pressuring China.
Can you do more?
Well, I think we have to pay attention to this issue. I'm sure the new administration will, but let me give you the example. Several hundred Chinese companies, just shy of 400, are providing dual-use technology to the Russian defense industrial base. They're allowing Putin, they're giving him the wherewithal to prosecute this war. We have sanctioned many of those companies. In my last week in Beijing, I just returned from China, I had four meetings with Chinese leaders, and in each meeting I said, this is the issue of the moment, and it's got to stop, and if it doesn't stop, we're going to continue to sanction you. That's a core American interest, and I would hope the new administration would follow it.
The worsening U.S. relations with China create problems for U.S. corporations, which still do hundreds of billions of dollars worth of business there. Ambassador Burns told us U.S. business leaders try to stay out of conflicts, and Burns understood because he says China's communist leaders don't tolerate criticism. This raises questions in the United States because an American billionaire who does a lot of business in China is now close to the incoming president, so close he will be on the platform when Trump takes the oath of office on Monday.
How many dealings, if any, did you have with Elon Musk over the years, who does so much business in China?
Not much. I mean, I exchanged emails with him at one time. I visited the Gigafactory. It's a very impressive Tesla factory outside of Shanghai. They've since built a battery factory there. It's a very successful company. We obviously want Tesla to succeed. And that's true of the, I visited, just to show you, GM and Ford, as well as Tesla, the big three there in Shanghai. It's a very important industry for the United States.
There are critics of Musk, even including some people in President-elect Trump's coalition, who will say, oh, you can't trust Elon Musk. He never speaks against China. He can't speak against China. What do you think about when you're here?
I don't think it would be fair for me to comment. I'll tell you why. Because I've had very limited one contact with him, really. He runs an important business there, and I don't want to be critical of American business leaders.
Do you think that American business leaders can speak freely and confidently, even if they have some exposure to the Chinese government?
Well, I think it's a problem when Americans are investing in any authoritarian country. They're often pressured by that government for business people not to speak up. So every business person, every company has to make its own determination. But I can tell you this. It's a very patriotic business community. I know them very well. Thousands of American businesses. They're American to the core. They want our country to succeed. But when it comes to international relations, it's usually a government-to-government dynamic in terms of the back and forth that you and I are having over these issues.
And you think that's the way that it ought to be? The U.S. government should say to the business community, don't worry about it. We're going to speak up for you. We're going to speak up for America.
You know, I think it depends. I mean, you know, American businesses all around the world, there may be cases where there are significant problems that, you know, American business leaders should speak up. But I don't want to preach to them. It's hard enough for American businesses to do business in China. We want them to be successful so that their companies can be successful here.
Ambassador Nicholas Burns, it's a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Steve.
President Biden's man in China formally resigns his office today.
This is NPR News.
The Palisades Fire destroyed more than 2,800 homes and buildings. One of them was the historic ranch house of Will Rogers, the vaudeville entertainer and trick roper.
There were some key things owned by Will, like his, you know, his boots, his typewriter. There was, you know, gifts that were really rare gifts made to the family.
We take stock of what's left on All Things Considered.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The Supreme Court is upholding a federal law to ban TikTok as of Sunday if, as NPR's Bobby Allen reports, the short-form video sharing app used by 170 million people in the U.S. alone fails to divest itself of Chinese ownership.
Basically, what this decision is saying is Congress decided that TikTok is a threat. They said, the users said, that they have First Amendment concerns, but the Supreme Court here is deferring to the judgment of Congress.
The U.S. says it is concerned the Chinese government could exploit TikTok to gain sensitive information from American users. Hours before the court decision, President-elect Trump says he and Chinese leader Xi Jinping talked by phone about TikTok, illegal fentanyl trafficking, and the ongoing U.S.-China trade dispute. President-elect Trump's pick to lead the nation's largest federal law enforcement agency, South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem, is appearing for her Senate confirmation hearing today. The nominee for Homeland Security Secretary says she thinks security at the southern border is key.
Border security must remain a top priority. As a nation, we have the right and the responsibility to secure our borders against those who would do us harm. And we must create a fair and a lawful immigration system that is efficient and is effective and that reflects our values.
Critics question Noem's qualifications to oversee a department of roughly 80,000 officers across 9 agencies and offices. You're listening to NPR News. The terms of a ceasefire agreement toward ending the 15-month-old Gaza war now have the Israeli security cabinet's backing, but the full cabinet still has to approve it. That could happen today. A ceasefire would be carried out in phases, starting with the exchange of Hamas-held hostages in exchange for Palestinian prisoners. Earlier today, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's office tweeted that if the agreement has the approval of the Israeli government, Hamas will release the first hostages Sunday. A Russian court has sentenced 3 lawyers of the late Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny to prison. Their terms are between 3.5 and 5.5 years. NPR's Charles Maines reports from Moscow. The case comes amid a wider Russian government crackdown on dissent.
The court found the lawyers guilty of aiding a terrorist organization through their legal representation of Navalny as he served out his own sentence on extremism charges widely seen as politically motivated. Russian authorities accused the lawyers of using their status as attorneys to help Navalny convey messages to the outside world before the opposition leader's death in an Arctic prison colony in February of last year. Navalny's wife, Yulia Navalnaya, who's carried on her husband's work in the wake of what she says was his murder, has called the lawyers political prisoners. The case was widely seen as part of a broader Kremlin effort to intimidate lawyers in Russia from defending government critics. Charles Maines, NPR News, Moscow.
On Wall Street, all major markets are up more than 1%. It's NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From the Cy Sims Foundation, partnering with organizations and people since 1985, working for a better and more just future for all. More information is available at CySimsFoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadel. The federal government and the pharmaceuticals industry are about to go head-to-head once again. The Biden administration, in its last full weekday in office, has announced the next 15 drugs up for Medicare price negotiations. It negotiated prices for the first batch of drugs last year, something that had never happened before. NPR pharmaceuticals correspondent Sydney Lupkin is here to talk to us about this. Hi, Sydney.
Hi.
Okay, so I guess first question is, what are the drugs?
Yeah, the big news is that Ozempic is on this list. Okay. The type 2 diabetes blockbuster is joined by its obesity drug cousin, Wegovy, which has the same active ingredient. It's also joined by drugs for various cancers, asthma, psoriasis, bipolar disorder. To be clear, the government can't pick just any drugs in Medicare. This all comes from Biden's Inflation Reduction Act. That gives rules for which drugs are eligible. They can't be brand new, for instance, and they can't have generic or biosimilar competition.
So it's the final hours of this administration. Why are they doing this now?
Yeah, they had until February 1st to announce the next batch of drugs according to the law and the other rules around this. This is a couple weeks before that deadline. I'm told CMS also had to use data in its drug selection process that ran through January 15th. But like you said, it's also the last full weekday where the Biden administration can kind of plant a flag and say, hey, we did this. It also keeps the ball rolling.
Could the incoming Trump administration put an end to the negotiations?
It is possible. It could repeal the Inflation Reduction Act, where Medicare gets this negotiating power. That is the plan, according to Project 2025, which was published by the Conservative Heritage Foundation and authored by several people at one point in Trump's orbit. Until a Republican-controlled Congress can repeal the Inflation Reduction Act, Project 2025 suggests implementing the existing law in a way that minimizes its effects. Though we should note, Trump has tried to distance himself from Project 2025, and he has said he wants to lower drug prices, so it's not really clear what will happen.
And what are the next steps in the process?
Yeah, this is the process that will play out over the next few months with rules and dates dictated by what's in the law. The drug companies have to agree to participate by the end of February. And if they say no, their drugs could get pulled from Medicare Part D. So that's more than 50 million potential customers lost. All the drug makers agreed the last time. The negotiations themselves will happen behind closed doors in the summer and fall. And around Halloween, the company have to accept or reject the final offer from the government. But those new prices won't take effect until January of 2027, so a ways away.
And you said earlier that this is the second batch of drugs where Medicare is negotiating prices. What happened with the first?
Right. Those negotiated prices for the first 10 drugs were announced in August and won't go into effect until January 2026. The government reached a lower price on all 10 of the drugs targeted, and it says that means taxpayers will save $6 billion next year. And the process with the second year could be smoother. That said, given the giant question mark around how the Trump administration will handle it, it's not clear exactly what will happen.
That's NPR's pharmaceuticals correspondent, Sydney Lupkin. Thank you, Sydney.
You bet.
On President Biden's final full weekday in office, we're looking back now at his legacy on education. NPR's Corey Turner asked more than a dozen educators, researchers, advocates, and experts how they would grade the president. Here's what he heard.
For this super unscientific poll, let's start with the grades Biden got from a few conservative voices.
NF, hard for me to think how it could have gone worse.
Rick Hess with the conservative-leaning American Enterprise Institute was not a fan.
Well, I would say incomplete, if that's allowed.
Margaret Spellings was Education Secretary under Republican President George W. Bush. And then there's Denise Fort, who runs the liberal-leaning Education Trust.
I'd sort of give them a C. I don't even know that I'd give them a C+.
Biden's best grade came from John B. King Jr., President Obama's former Education Secretary.
It's a B with still much to be determined.
Of the 14 folks I consulted, Biden got two Fs, no As, and a whole lot of votes in the mushy middle. So let's talk substance. And the one thing that folks thought Biden handled pretty well.
Tons of resources flowed to schools in the aftermath of COVID.
Former Secretary Spellings points out Biden and Congress quickly sent schools an extra $122 billion in emergency funding.
That was done efficiently. I think they rightly put a focus on learning loss and those sorts of things that we know help students catch up.
And former Secretary King says Biden's secretary, Miguel Cardona, a former teacher, helped restore a sense of normalcy to schools.
Secretary Cardona came in with the task of trying to make sure that kids got back in school and that educators could be hopeful again. And I'm very grateful.
So that's K-12. Higher education was a different story.
Yeah, again, when we think back, we're like,
Oh my gosh, that was so bad.
Karen McCarthy works for the National Association of Student Financial Aid Administrators, and she's talking about the one thing that just about everybody agreed was the biggest failure of Biden's tenure, the troubled rollout of last year's free application for federal student aid, the FAFSA.
As best I can tell, the Biden legacy is making a debacle out of FAFSA simplification.
And Rick Hess at AEI is not alone in his choice of words. Here's former Obama Ed Secretary John King.
The FAFSA debacle, and that's what we have to call it, set us back.
Congress tasked the department with making the form easier to fill out, but the new FAFSA arrived late, and it was a nightmare for students and colleges both. Denise Fort at EdTrust says the department should have done better.
I mean, all you had to do is look at healthcare.gov and know that we should have been dotting I's and crossing T's. And that, unfortunately, didn't happen.
The latest FAFSA rolled out recently and went much more smoothly. There's one more big issue that will help define Biden's education legacy.
Effectively, all of the attempts to provide student loan debt amnesty have been slapped down by the courts.
Lindsay Burke at the conservative-leaning Heritage Foundation.
It should have never happened. Student loan cancellation is bad policy, but it's a failure in terms of the Biden administration's ability to advance its agenda. It's failed completely on that.
Not completely. The Biden team did end up forgiving the debts of more than 5 million borrowers by reworking programs that Congress had already created. In all, Biden's average grade from our bipartisan education panel turned out to be pretty average, a middle-of-the-road C. Cory Turner, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Are you feeling cynical, hopeless about politics? One activist says, hold the thought. He argues active civic engagement can help. Next time, Here and Now.
Your city, your station, your news. Download the NPR app today. Your new home for live radio, local podcasts, and everything you love from NPR.
Good morning, I'm Michelle Martin. The broadcaster known as Mr. Baseball has died. He was 90 years old. Bob Uecker was the much-loved Milwaukee Brewers radio announcer for 53 years. His quick wit and instinct for comedy, though, made him a pop culture favorite far beyond sports. He did Miller Lite commercials, appeared frequently on Johnny Carson's Tonight Show, and played the role of wisecracking baseball announcer Harry Doyle in the Major League movies.
Just a bit outside. He tried.
It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the George Gund Foundation, working to make Cleveland more vibrant, sustainable, and just, and setting an example for the nation. More information available at gundfoundation.org. From the Doris Duke Foundation, which aims to support the well-being of people and the planet for a more creative, equitable, and sustainable future. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, at WTGrantFDN.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. Mortgage rates have edged back up to above 7%. That's despite the Federal Reserve cutting interest rates by a full point last year. It's another drag on the country's already tough housing market. So what should you do if you're hoping to buy a home? We're going to ask Mark Hamrick. He is the Washington Bureau Chief for Bankrate. That's a personal finance website. Mark, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
Can we start with the why? Why are mortgage rates rising again after the Fed cut interest rates?
There's a lot of confusion about that relationship. And first of all, the Fed doesn't really control mortgage rates, although it does control a lot of things. What mortgage rates are really connected to is the yield of the 10-year Treasury bond. And those yields have risen rather sharply since last fall on the anticipation that economic growth may be robust along with inflation in the current year. The ambitious hopes of the incoming administration with respect to the economy, including the potential for deficit spending, have inflamed those considerations. And that's why we now do have that 7% 30-year fixed rate mortgage again.
So let's wheel around to what you can do if you're trying to get into a home. Is there something you can do to get a lower rate? Can you negotiate this?
Well, let's start first of all with what you can do even before you get to that part of the process. And to have a stellar credit score helps to qualify for a lower mortgage rate. And so that will save you money on the mortgage. And so if you have a superior credit score, which shows that you are a good bill payer, that you are qualified to get a mortgage, then you shop around for the best rate. Many people do not think about shopping around. They may take the first mortgage rate or relationship that, for example, their realtor suggests to them. Those are very often very well baked in relationships that don't necessarily work well or optimally for the prospective home buyer. Thirdly, is to get pre-qualified for a mortgage, to know what you can afford and what you are qualified for. And then you are a better, let's say, looking potential buyer. If you're already qualified, they don't have to worry whether indeed you can get the mortgage that you'll need to pay for the home. But also think about, let's say, limiting our expectations for the home that we're going to purchase at a time when home prices have continued to rise. Can we take something that's a little less or even move elsewhere where it doesn't cost as much?
Any tips for sellers?
This is a good market for sellers because the number one problem right now is lack of supply. And in the past, where you might have had to sort of buff and shine your home to get it sold. Of course, we're talking generally. Markets are varying widely depending on demand for homes. But I think sellers may need to wait a little bit longer because of the lack of prospective buyers in this affordability challenge market. But they still hold the upper hand here.
And a tricky question, briefly, what about waiting? Maybe people should just wait.
There is no shame in renting. And if we can save more money to fight another day to buy that home, I'd rather have people have more money in savings, because once you buy that home, you're going to spend money on other things.
That is Mark Hamrick. He's the Washington Bureau Chief for the personal finance website Bankrate. Mark Hamrick, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
This is NPR News. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Layla Faldin. Good morning. In Los Angeles, crews from the Environmental Protection Agency are showing up in hazmat suits. They're digging through all the potential hazardous waste the fires have left behind. NPR's Ping Huang reports.
It's a huge, dangerous, problematic mess. That's what the wildfires have left behind.
Pesticides, fertilizers, paint, solvents.
Steve Kalanog is the EPA's deputy incident commander for the Southern California wildfires.
Cleaners, compressed gas cylinders.
He says what they're looking for are typical household items turned dangerous by the heat.
Pottery kilns and things like that. And then, of course, there's always a plethora of damaged ammunition from sporting rifles and what have you.
All of these are things that could react, explode, or cause corrosion and other problems if they leak. Kalanog has worked on cleanups after wildfires for more than 15 years. A huge problem he's seen in recent times is lithium-ion batteries in electric cars. He says they can catastrophically catch fire in the days, weeks, and even months ahead.
We have to treat them as an unexploded ordnance, and we have to take great care of removing them from vehicles. We have to take great care in transporting them to the appropriate location to render them safe.
And then there are the invisible dangers. Crew members come with air monitors and detectors to look for explosive or toxic compounds, and even sometimes radiation. Kalanog's message to the general public is don't try to clean this up yourself.
All of our team are outfitted with air purifying respirators, hard hats, head-to-toe Tyvek, and other protective gear.
And they're trained to deal with things like asbestos, used to fireproof old homes, which can contribute to lung disease and cancer risks if inhaled. The Los Angeles wildfires have burned more than 12,000 structures and 40,000 acres. So Kalanog says this first phase, it may take a few months. But even after it's done, it doesn't mean your property is safe.
There's partially destroyed structures where walls can collapse, and certainly plenty of things like broken glass and nails that folks can injure themselves on.
It's at this point in the process with this kind of debris that the cleanup gets turned over to the Army Corps of Engineers and contractors. Yana Garcia is California's Secretary for Environmental Protection. She knows that people are eager to get back to their properties, but she can't say when that will happen.
We completely understand the extraordinary, unprecedented nature of the devastation that we're facing across the Los Angeles area.
She's hoping people can be patient a little longer.
We are maintaining the sense of urgency and the priority to get everyone back onto their property as soon as possible.
It's important to do the cleanup right, she says, to keep people from getting sick or hurt now and in the long run. Ping Huang, NPR News.
Now to an environmental challenge on the other side of the country, Florida's endangered freshwater springs. They are magnets for wildlife and for people who want to swim or paddle in crystal clear water. But now, development and pumping of groundwater are taking a toll. Some springs no longer bubble up from the aquifer. Even the largest are now seeing their flow steadily reduced. NPR's Greg Allen looks at the state's response.
In a county park just north of Orlando, water gushes from a limestone cliff.
This is Rock Springs. This is the head spring. This is basically rainwater that's percolated down through the recharge area.
Mike Clyburn with Friends of the Wakaiva River says hundreds of gallons of water pour from the spring every second. The water makes its way into the Wakaiva, one of Florida's most unspoiled rivers. Because of its unique geology, Florida has one of the largest concentrations of freshwater springs anywhere in the world. They provide important habitat for endangered and threatened species, including manatees. But they're also important for recreation, attracting locals and visitors who come to paddle, tube, or swim in the water. Always a uniform 72 degrees. But Florida's springs face an uncertain future. A boom in housing construction has led Central Florida's Water Management District to issue more permits allowing groundwater withdrawals. So much water is now being pumped from the aquifer, Jay Exum says, that the amount that flows from Rock and nearby Wakaiva Springs has gone down. Exum, with Friends of the Wakaiva River, says with additional construction being approved all the time, requests for groundwater permits are only going to increase.
We know that there's going to be such a strain on the groundwater that the result is going to be a decrease in flow at Wakaiva and Rock Springs. And they've said so. The Water Management District knows it.
In some parts of Florida, springs have stopped flowing or become choked by algae because of low flows and pollution caused by development. To head off more damage, in 2016, then-Florida Governor Rick Scott signed a law requiring the state's Department of Environmental Protection to issue rules that would prevent groundwater withdrawals that harm springs. For nearly a decade, though, the DEP took no action until late last year. In response to a lawsuit filed by an environmental group, the Florida Springs Council, the agency finally proposed the long-awaited regulations. But Florida Springs Council Executive Director Ryan Smart says the new rules are essentially the same as the ones that have long been in place.
They have a lot of discretion on what those rules look like, but at the end of the day, they do have to prevent harm. And the current rules, which are the same as the rules they are proposing, do not prevent harm.
Florida's DEP didn't respond to requests for an interview. Smart says the environmental group and regulators agree on one thing. Florida Springs are in trouble.
The DEP and the water management districts have determined that significant harm, which is typically over 15% habitat loss, is already occurring. And we need to stop the destruction before things get so bad that it's ruined.
Here's a little alligator to the right.
Oh yeah, look at that guy.
Paddling on the Wekiva River, Florida's spring-fed ecosystem looks in pretty good shape. Red-bellied woodpeckers fly overhead. Little blue herons wade on the riverbank, and turtles sun on partially submerged logs. But over the last 2 years, Orlando has been the nation's second fastest growing region, and new residential construction is booming. Jay Exum says that's why it's important for the state to adopt environmental protections for the springs that were ordered by lawmakers nearly a decade ago.
50% of the water withdrawn from the Florida aquifer is used to irrigate residential lawns. So, sure, development is an impact, but it's what we do after the development that may cause the greatest impact, and we have the ability to change that.
Florida's Department of Environmental Protection is moving ahead with its proposed rules. If they're finalized as is, the Florida Springs Council says it will challenge them in court. Greg Allen, NPR News, Wekiwa Springs, Florida.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Our theme music was inspired by BJ Lederman. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Layla Fault.